Welcome back to Season 4 of Media Minded, the show that guides you through the age of disinformation. In this episode, we come theoretically face to face with one of the world's most deadly and infamous terrorist groups, Boko Haram. That name might ring a bell. In 2014, the terrorist group made international headlines for kidnapping over 200 schoolgirls in Nigeria. As of 2023, 96 of those girls still remain in captivity. But this kidnapping represents just a small portion of the violence committed by the group since their founding in 2002. Stay tuned as we talk to people on the ground risking their lives to keep their communities safe from Boko Haram and other Islamic jihadist groups in West Africa. This podcast is produced by Shoutout UK, the leading political and media literacy education platform, and is made possible by the generous support and sponsorship of the Global Engagement Center at the US State Department. I am your host, Matteo Bergamini, founder and CEO of Shoutout UK, here to challenge your understanding of the world around you, and hopefully not your attention span. Time for some background. Boko Haram is a militant Islamist group operating largely in northeast Nigeria and close to the Niger border with the goal of establishing strict Sharia law. In case you didn't know, Sharia is Islam's legal system, derived directly from the Quran, Islam's holy book, and other religious texts. There are many ways Sharia law can be interpreted and practiced, though the way Boko Haram chooses to impose it is incredibly restrictive, especially for women. The name Boko Haram translates to Western education is forbidden, as Boko is a holdover from the colonial English word for book, and Haram means forbidden. Members are not allowed to practice any political or social activity associated with Western society. Originally founded in 2002 in Nigeria's northeastern Borno state by a cleric named Muhammad Yusuf, the group has always been opposed to westernization. But they didn't become violent until 2009, when they began to fight with security forces. After the police captured and killed Yusuf, a formidable leader named Abu Bakar Shekau took over and brought Boko Haram to its peak in 2015. When it controlled an area allegedly the size of Belgium. Life under the group was grim for everyone, but especially for its victims.
I embedded with the military for 4 days and I visited over 10 hard to reach areas. In fact, it was scary because we moved at slow pace and we had soldiers having to stop to check the road for improvised explosive devices, and it was really scary. And we visited Bama. Bama is a local government that is 70 kilometers from Maiduguri, the capital. And it is after Maiduguri, after the state capital, it is the second largest town. What I saw from the helicopter from the air was a complete destruction of the whole town. The only structures, the few structures left standing, were few buildings within the hospital compound. And that was because those were the houses that Boko Haram stayed in, Boko Haram fighters stayed in when they occupied the town. So it was, Bama is big. They destroyed everything. So seeing that, and when finally territories were recovered and people started coming out, it was even worse, because now we're talking about humans, not even just not just buildings or infrastructure, but we're talking about people. And like I mentioned, we saw people who, for instance, a child crying was good news to the mother because it meant the child was alive. So it was that bad. A child could sleep and not wake up. You know, it was, and I remember in Pulka, one of these communities, some people were brought out, and an elderly woman, she was given food. She saw the food. She was so excited that she died from that excitement. And then we found out that they could not remember when last they saw food. For days, they had not seen food. So sometimes it's difficult, really, to put into words the conditions that people were in between 2015 and 2017, when people and mass were brought out of this hard-to-reach areas.
You've just heard from Malik Samuel, a journalist turned researcher focused on Africa's Lake Chad Basin region, which encompasses territory in Nigeria, Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. Malik's research and reporting focuses on what he calls the Boko Haram crisis, encompassing anything from the humanitarian fallout from attacks, the impact on women, children, and the elderly, and how to manage the exit of group members and reintegrate them back into society. He also looks at the financing of Boko Haram, as well as the link between terrorism and criminality in northwest Nigeria. As Malik detailed, the death and destruction inflicted by Boko Haram has been far-reaching and gruesome. The conflict has spurred one of the worst humanitarian crises on earth, forcing millions to flee their homes and cutting off their access to basic human needs like food, clean water, and medicine. The UN estimates that at the end of 2020, 350,000 people had been killed by the conflict with insurgents in Nigeria's northeast. Children under 5 years old accounted for more than 90% of those killed as a result of the conflict and its humanitarian fallout. The agency went on to say that if the conflict continues until 2030, more than 1.1 million people may die. Young people, who have grown up in the shadow of this crisis, are arguably its most affected victims. Our second guest, Dauda Mohammed Gombe, is the founder and executive director of the Northeast Youth Initiative Forum, or NAYF. It's a civil society organization based in Nigeria that was founded to provide support to society's most vulnerable members, namely young people, and is committed to the promotion of peace and unity. Listen to Dauda's passion as he explains his organization's mission of helping young people and communities affected by the Boko Haram conflict.
For NAYF, since we established the organization, like I tell you, the first thing was to look at how to contribute our own quota to promote peaceful coexistence in our society. And we started by engaging relevant stakeholders, calling for dialogues, even at the heart of Boko Haram crisis. I remember we held several dialogues with military, police, traditional leaders, young people, political leaders, and separately across the northeastern state then, because at then we focus on the six northeastern states. We hold it in Bauchi and the rest. And we also engage into governance and the rest. But as time goes on, we metamorphose into full-blown civil society organization where we work currently on three nexus plus two. The three nexus are humanitarian development, peace building slash prevention and countering violent extremism, while the plus two is community engagement and capacity building. Under the capacity building, we talk about capacity building of individuals and groups. So in this activity we are doing, you know, when providing humanitarian support should be an integrated approach, whereby you will not just go to people who are just being displaced, and you start talking about education, or you start talking about, no, you have to look at, okay, what is the immediate need at that time? That time, maybe it's a shelter. They need a safe place where they can sleep. From then, maybe food. From then, maybe health. Then think about wash and other things. And also, as the time goes on, you think about education while you engage them. And all the activities we do in NAYF, we try to ensure that it is community-led initiatives. Communities own the process, own the program, so that at the end of the day, even if we left that community, it will be sustained. There will be a sustainability.
This emphasis on community-led initiatives highlights the importance of empowering local voices and fostering long-term sustainability. Addressing the root causes of conflict, encouraging dialogue between stakeholders, and promoting critical thinking skills within communities are all crucial steps to creating lasting peace. Turning back to the operations of Boko Haram, in 2015, the group and its leader, Abu Bakr Shekau, pledged allegiance to ISIS, which stands for the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, also known as Daesh. This decision to link themselves to ISIS did not sit well with Shekau, who felt he had been forced into it by his inner circle. Tensions in the group grew. Shekau was known to be a very authoritative and erratic figure, and some of Boko Haram's top commanders started to express discontent with the direction of the group. Eventually, in 2016, Boko Haram split into two factions. Jama'atu Alis Sunna Lidati Wal Jihad, better known as JAS, which was Boko Haram's formal name when the group started. JAS continued to be led by Abu Bakr Shekau. The second group is the Islamic State West Africa Province, or ISWAP, which continues to be the official ISIS affiliate. I asked Malik what caused the split.
It was basically the treatment of civilians, Muslim civilians. Shekau, as far as he was concerned, whoever was not in support of him was against him, was an apostate, was an infidel that should be killed, whether or not he was Muslim. But he had people within his camp, his inner circle, who said, who thought otherwise, that Muslim civilians should not be targeted. Because you saw that during Shekau's time, there were attacks in mosques, there were attacks in Muslim communities, Muslim civilian communities. And so some of his commanders were not happy. And when they made their objection known to Shekau, Shekau did not take that lightly. So he started assassinating his own commanders. Yeah, so some of these guys became fearful, you know, for their lives.
As you would.
Absolutely. So the son of Muhammad Yusuf, the founder of the group, so his son and Mama Nur, one of the clerics then, they just took some of the fighters and they fled. They ran away from Sambisa Forest, and that was how they came to be around the lake. They fled to around to the Lake Chad area. So that was where they stayed as their new base. So that split was triggered by the treatment of civilians. And you'd see that even to date, that is the distinction between the two groups, how they operate. While JAS attacks civilians, abduct civilians, and all that, ISWAP, on the other hand, tries as much as possible not to attack civilians. It does what is known as the winning of hearts and minds. So it's rather cuts civilians, you know, wants civilians to come to its areas to live under it, to do business, to trade, you know, and all that, in exchange for tax and, you know, and all. So the way they treat the two groups, treat civilians, was a major sticking point that resulted in that split.
For a group that has caused so much death and destruction, how to treat civilians seems like an ironic point of contention that would lead to a major split. Currently, ISWAP is the more dominant faction in West Africa, with JAS having taken some big hits in the last couple of years. Notably, the killing of its leader, Shekau. ISWAP controls a large chunk of territory in Nigeria's Borno state, as well as land in the Lake Chad Basin area. They also took over JAS's long-time base in the Zambeze Forest, running the group into the Mandara Mountains on the Nigeria-Cameroon border. ISWAP is allegedly the most successful ISIS affiliate in the world. In 2018, ISWAP was estimated to have 3,500 fighters, over 2,000 more than the next biggest ISIS affiliate in Africa. I wanted to know why, if ISWAP is so strong, is the group allied with ISIS? What type of support does ISIS provide?
The support comes in the form of training. ISIS sends people with different expertise to lecture to train ISWAP, whether fighters, to train fighters or to train them on administration. For instance, I mentioned the issue of spoils of war. ISWAP had a problem before 2021, whereby the spoils of war were kept by the state and the fighters were left unpaid. Some fighters left. I mentioned earlier that some people joined for economic reasons. So some of them had to leave. So when ISWAP, when there was a change in 2021, when Al-Banawi took over leadership of the group, he pledged to carry out some reforms. One of the reforms was the issue of spoils of war, that fighters would be given their shares of spoils of war. They would decide what to do with it. But of course, many of the fighters would want to sell to the state because that was how they would make money. Now, ISIS provided guidance about how to monetize this spoils of war. I mean, how to value the spoils of war. The AK-47, for instance, would be different from an RPG. You know, the value for RPG would be different from a pickup truck that you got, or from military uniforms, you know, and all that. So ISIS provided help in valuing this, and also. ISWAP, when I talked about training of fighters, before the split, or even shortly after the split, you had a situation where you had situations where ISWAP carried out attacks by sending large number of fighters at the same time, and it was easy for the military to engage them. If you just maybe drop a bomb, it would kill more people. And stuff like that. So former fighters we spoke to said one of the tactical decisions that ISIS helped with was to tell them, no, you don't go with a huge number of fighters. First, you need to carry out surveillance. You need to carry out reconnaissance. You need to know the territory where you're attacking. You need to know how strong the area is. If it is not that strong, you don't need to go with so many people. You go with few fighters well equipped to do this. Then you need to position about the positioning, different groups. So ISWAP helped them with this, with the tactical, I would say, expertise for carrying out attacks. And then communication, publicity is huge. You know, a lot of the communication we see that comes out. It's released by, it's produced by ISIS. Produced by ISIS, disseminated by ISIS as well. So you have ISWAP carrying out attacks. They have a media unit. So they embed their media guys with fighters. So when they go for attack, these media guys are in charge of taking photos, recording videos, you know, and all that. So they also have Wi-Fis. A lot of times they go with this equipment, the Wi-Fi and all that, so that right there they don't need to go back to base before sending the materials to ISIS. So they send the materials to ISIS comms, to the guys in charge of ISIS communication. So these ISIS guys, comms guys, produce the materials, and then they disseminate through different channels, especially through Telegram. And I'm sure you know about AMAC news agency, which is the ISIS news agency that produces lots of this communication. So these are some of the support it also received. And then in terms of leadership, ISIS helps with advice and also recommendation about who becomes the leader, if a leader is to be replaced. You know, ISIS significantly does not impose decisions on ISWAP. No, it only provides guidance. And that is because it understands that ISWAP is very strong. ISWAP is the most successful ISIS affiliate, if you check. It's the biggest in terms of number of fighters, in terms of revenues, in terms of successes in, when you look at attacks. So ISIS respects ISWAP. So it doesn't impose its decision on ISWAP, but rather provides guidance, advice, you know, and all that. Yeah.
ISIS gets a major boost in popularity out of its support of ISWAP. Its power in the Middle East, where the group was first established, is waning, while ISWAP is growing. ISIS is now looking towards Africa to expand its operations and mission of establishing its own Islamic State. Malik mentioned that ISIS helped ISWAP revamp its incentive program, administration, and, most importantly, finances. However, and call this strategy or just great timing, but shortly after Boko Haram split in two, the Nigerian government launched one of the largest and strongest offenses to take back much of the captured lands. This offensive was triggered by a variety of factors, including public pressure on how much territory Boko Haram was able to control, international pressure from other nations and human rights groups, and, perhaps most politically persuasive, the immense economic consequences of the conflict. Although controlling less territory, Boko Haram is still a formidable financial powerhouse.
The ISS did a research, I think about 2 years ago, that basically looked at the sustainability of Boko Haram with a focus on ISWAP, how it generates its revenue. You know, and I mentioned earlier that before the advent of Boko Haram, the Lake Chad Basin area was thriving economically. And so what the group has done is that fishing is a major economic activity in that area. And so, and people may, when you say fishing, people may not understand how huge it is. But if you consider that back then, I remember I grew up in the south of Nigeria, southwest. Lots of the dry fish we had in that area was coming from Lake Chad. So the fish from there went as far as the whole of Nigeria, and then you had farming activities that was all year round, not rainy season or dry season, but all year round farming activities, you know, happen in this area. And the northeast, I think, is the largest entry point for cattle into Nigeria, and it's a big one of the biggest cattle market is found in Adamawa State. I remember when I visited the market, they traded the volume of trade then a week, when they told me I think back then, based on the current, the exchange rate would be around $3 million weekly in the biggest cattle market then in Adamawa State. Now you're having these guys controlling most of this business activities. And now you can imagine the millions they raise. Now, for everybody fishing in Lake Chad right now, because ISWAP is in control of that area, you have to pay tax. You have to, and the tax, there are different ways of paying the tax. There are different levies. You pay for permit to fish. You pay when the fish is processed. You need to take the fish out of the lake. You need to pay that, and then there you have the cattle, like I mentioned. Yeah, you have to also pay tax on every cow, on every livestock. On every animal you have to pay. For those who cultivate the land, you also have to pay. For people involved in trading, in buying and selling, in market, they also have to pay. So the research the ISS did 2 years ago, I mentioned, I think if I'm correct, it's around 10 or more than $10 million dollars that Israel was making in the Lake Chad, annually. And the way it deploys this money is important. The fighters, they are not paid directly to say, this is your monthly salary or weekly salary or whatever. They are paid based on the attacks, when they go for attacks, and then they recover whatever they get, the loot, spoils of war. When they come back with spoils of war, whether military weapons, military uniforms, whatever they bring. So the Islamic State now, ISWAP, buys this thing off the fighters. So this is how they make money. And before they go for attacks, they have to take care of the families they leave behind. So ISWAP needs money for this. And during the attacks, they also need money for feeding of the fighters while in the battlefield. They need money for fuel and all this. So they use this money to do, to do this activity. So it tells you that if you deny them access to these funds, if you deny them access to these resources, it will be difficult for them to operate. Because former fighters who have left the group have told me that if you cut these sources of funding to ISWAP, it will be difficult for them to sustain fighters, because not everybody joined them for ideological reasons. Some people joined them because they wanted to get economic benefit. So if they no longer get the economic benefit, they no longer get money, as members of ISWAP, of course they would leave. They want to leave. So if fighters leave, the group, of course, would be depleted.
It's clear how exploitative Boko Haram is of the civilians that live in its territories, who bear the brunt of the economic burden. These civilians don't necessarily want to be part of the ISWAP machine, but their only other choice would be to flee their homes, which is a dangerous endeavor. We mentioned earlier that ISWAP does not attack Muslim civilians. That is, of course, if they pay their taxes. For civilians, it's about survival. Speaking of survival, understanding the nature of their initial attacks can support us in understanding the effect they have on communities and future generations. So I turn to Dauda, who works directly with communities affected by Boko Haram.
I can say there are usually three ways that these groups usually attack communities. One, we know that if military conduct an operation and eventually one of them or some of them were arrested, all their properties are destroyed, definitely we know a reprisal attack is coming and is going to happen. And that will affect everybody. But their main target is those who done that to them. So if they are able to overpower them, then the next thing, they will go on to the people. So if eventually they are looking for something in the community, they also go and attack the community. For instance, during the lean season or the raining season, when their food stock goes down and they are in need of food and water have barricaded them from crossing to go and do much attack other places, they attack communities and took away their food. Sometimes those kind of attack, the community used to have information. So those who got the information used to run away. Those who stay, face the challenge of that. And the third way sometimes is they used to send message that, okay, you have betrayed us or this, and we are coming to attack you, or we are going there. Because, in up to now, there are some villages that they are under their control, and they have a negotiation, they have an understanding, and they pay, tithe or something like that, like taxes like that to them. So they attack anyhow, and sometimes they attack under that tax category. If they are targeting a particular community and they fast, and before they reach their community, they heard that from that community, they have informed the community they are targeting, they will come back and attack that community, and they will ensure that they completely raise down that community. These are some of the attacks that happened like last year in Yobe, in one of the villages, when they are targeting another community. The community members called the community and informed. They now abandoned that mission, came back because they have their informers, killed about 40 people there, set ablaze and planted bomb on this. The next day when they are taking the dead ones to graveyard, they suddenly, clinch up the and the bomb, and they, and many other people also die. So they have many means that they conduct attack, but usually they do it randomly, and they don't care which community is that and what consequences. But they don't do attacks in the community where they are the majority.
Perhaps the most unsettling aspect of Boko Haram's attacks is their seemingly indiscriminate nature, imposing constant fear on entire communities. Extremist groups like ISWAP and JAS actively exploit and perpetuate this cycle of fear and violence to maintain their power. Yet their recruitment is certainly not indiscriminate. A heavy focus is placed on the most vulnerable in our society, children, in particular young boys. Nigeria actually has the largest population of young people in the world. According to UN data, about 70% of the population is under 30, and 42% is under the age of 15. Malik explained that these boys are key to the success of ISWAP.
ISWAP sees young boys as the future. And it's also because it is easy to brainwash children. It's easy to win over children. And we see this in how it treats these boys. They get these boys from different villages that they attack. They abduct a lot of these children. Now, if you look at the leadership of ISWAP, a lot of its commanders, the rank of Kaids, the Kaids are very high in terms of ranking. They're very high. A lot of these Kaids are young boys, are boys in their early 20s. You see very few that are in their late or in their mid or late 30s. And then you consider how long ISWAP has been in existence. You look at let's say Boko Haram as a whole, when it's 15th year. And if you see that some of these guys are in their late, in their mid 20s, early 30s, you see that when they joined the group, they were kids. So now, when they take some of these children, these guys, they have people they look up to. These young boys, these children, they know that they can be like these boys, these commanders that they see. Because during the training, it is these commanders, some of them are instructors. ISWAP has a program, the recruitment program for these boys. So where you have these instructors go there to train the boys. And a lot of them, some of these boys have told us who eventually left one reason or another, tell us that during this training, during the all they think, all they want to do is to go to the field and fight. And ISWAP, incentivizes them by providing different incentives. If you perform well, you have gift. You have gift. Either you have the Quran as a gift, or you have AK-47, or you have motorcycle, or you have a commander taking you as his bodyguard. So for them, it's a privilege that a commander takes them as their bodyguard, as their mentees. You know. So these boys, these young children, they look up. They have something to look up to. No, so it is easy to sell this message to children than to some adults who can make decisions, for themselves.
Boko Haram sees these children as blank slates, easier to indoctrinate and manipulate, offering them a twisted sense of purpose, success, and belonging in exchange for their loyalty. These young boys are groomed and incentivized to become the next generation of fighters. But this comes at a devastating cost, not just for the children themselves, but for the communities as well. There is such a large humanitarian toll to living in conflict, which we have discussed extensively on this episode. This includes a massive emotional toll, a toll on mental health of living in conflict that will likely affect communities for the rest of their lives. Dada told me what it's like for him and others that live in the midst of war that robs them of their sense of security.
None of us live today in a manner that he's saying that I am safe, but we sleep with one eye closed, having felt that the military are doing the needful and they improve security situation, but still having fear that these people still live within us and can strike at any time because they don't have color. Those that you know are no longer alive, either they have been killed or they are in the bushes, have become the bigger ones whom you don't know. So those that are doing now the attacks, you don't know them, and the people are still have that fear, and the people have become so much fear that they cannot even feed themselves.
Dauda paints a stark and terrifying picture of life lived during violent conflict. It's a fear that burrows deep in the fabric of society, poisoning one of the most basic aspects of life, the ability to feel safe and secure. This fear, as crippling as it is a crucial piece of the story. Cannot be ignored, minimized, or dismissed as collateral damage. It demands our attention, our empathy, and, most importantly, our action. Addressing the root causes of conflict, learning the skills to protect ourselves and loved ones from going down such a path, and building a future free from fear, these are not distant dreams, but urgent calls to action. The stories we've heard today are important to share. Thank you so much to both Dauda and Malik for providing insight into Boko Haram and the devastating impact the group has had on Nigeria. To our listeners, thank you for joining us for Season 4 of Media Minded, the show guiding you through the age of disinformation. This podcast is produced by Shoutout UK. Make sure to follow Shoutout UK on X and Instagram to get updates on all our upcoming episodes. And don't forget to subscribe to the Media Minded podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast fix. This podcast is made possible by the generous support and sponsorship of the US State Department. Thank you for listening, and remember, stay informed.